Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
So, for example, I had a student who is an otherwise stellar student, A student. He's like, oh, yeah, I just took this, you know, district math exam. I said, okay, great. How'd you do? He's like, oh, I got like a C on it. I'm like, oh, well, that's not typical for you. He's like, yeah, but don't worry. They're going to curve it. What they do is they have these kids take the test. They curve it behind the scenes when they say, well, they didn't actually meet the standards, so we got to do remediation. And then they sell more remediation packets, you know, and more extensive learning. That has also disheartened kids.
All right. So they know their grades were back to like ninth place ribbons, right? And the psychic effect that has on people. Like, so now that's applied to academics.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, curve behind the scenes, like you said, that takes care of like the front end as far as like what the school needs to show as far as achievement is concerned. But in the back, we're going to kind of punish you with time and your sense of yourself anyway by remediating you because we have contractors to pay.
Yeah. Do you believe what you see? Motionless we, nothing is real. Wasting my time in the waiting line. Do you believe in what you see?
Everybody, this is Brett. Today is Wednesday, February 19th. We are about to jump right into the continuation of my conversation with the Honest Teacher. But first, I would ask you to click the link in the show notes or just go to Facebook and search The Honest Teacher. Like this page, follow this page.
And usually in these monologues, I promote supporting School Sucks. I mean, you probably listen to plenty of podcasts. You know the drill, how content creators are always like, oh, give me some money so I can keep doing my show. The bigger we get and the more ambitious we try to be, the more expensive it is.
Whatever, dude. But when people are starting out or changing directions, they need support to make those things happen, but they also need support as a form of encouragement. So The Honest Teacher is really successful as a Facebook page, but he's also trying to, you know, create videos and commentary on, you know, a lot of the topics we discuss here. And in this pursuit, I say the more, the merrier. Jay is so knowledgeable, he's so well-spoken, and he's just so on message. I want to support and encourage him, so I chipped in on his Patreon. That is at patreon.com/thehonestteacher. He's just starting that, so I would love it if he could get a really nice boost from this show, and I think that's one of his priorities right now. Today's show overlaps the last conversation by about 30 seconds, so we'll pick up talking about how labels disable. We'll talk about our experiences writing IEPs and some of the issues that we wrote IEPs for. How Common Core cronyism connects to the conversations you heard on this show from last week. Specifically, you remember how I was talking with Pete Quinones about outcome-based education and the revelations about that in the 1980s and the 1990s, thanks to people like Peg Luxick in Pennsylvania. We've got 21st century updates, like right up to the present day, on how remediation works in these schools. We'll also talk about how there is currently unprecedented teacher turnover and why it's happening and what that means for students. We'll do an expansion on what Jay, the Honest Teacher, means by current state of schools is an Orwellian nightmare. And we'll wrap up today in a really lovely fashion talking about the mission and the future of the Honest Teacher. And the Ideas into Action Summit Encore is March 7th. It's also the 14th and the 21st. Spread over three Saturdays. That's pretty manageable. Come spend 5 or 6 hours a day with me or less. You can come and go as you please. This ain't school. It's the university. It's about university, by the way. Please go to ssponiversity.com/ideas into action. If you are feeling overloaded with information, if you feel like you're spending a little too much time on social media, if you feel like you could learn more effectively and efficiently, if you feel like your create to consume ratio could be increased, and if you wish to be more persuasive, please just go look at what we've put together, and the offer still stands. If you're like, ah, Brad, it's just out of my budget. After all, if I had these skills, I'd already be rich. Just email me. Don't be shy. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. I loved these conversations. I hope you did, too. Take care.
The young people are just being treated as if there's something wrong with them or dysfunctional. They're being told, oh, you know, you have a problem, you know, there's something that's fundamentally wrong with you, we need to get you these special accommodations, things like that. And of course, you know, even without that, it's just there's no respect of individual development or autonomy. There's no respect of understanding individual biology or outside life circumstances that might be affecting them. It's just, okay, do whatever you have to do to make sure they pass these tests.
And if you're not right, disabled, we'll disable you with a label.
Yeah.
Which is what I saw. Well, I can't do that. Or the determinism of like, well, as somebody with Asperger's or as somebody on the spectrum or as somebody with Tourette's, I can't, I won't, I don't, I shouldn't, I need. And really just kind of accepting the DSM-4, the DSM-5 definition, like, and applying it to themselves, like that becomes who they are. Right. Mm-hmm. That was a very sad and frustrating thing to watch.
Absolutely. And, you know, when the autism, now it's a spectrum, you know, became from single diagnosis to a spectrum and more people got included who are, you know, Asperger's and things like that. It just became more of an opportunity to do this kind of thing. It's like, oh, okay, well, we'll just find some label within the spectrum that sticks. And then boom, we got them in for their, you know, IEP or 504 accommodations. And it's very frustrating to see because, again, there are definitely young people out there who have disabilities or have chemical imbalances that, you know, fundamentally it's a chemical issue and it affects their ability to actually function.
Indeed. Yep.
But within the context of the schooling paradigm, the fundamental flaw, and I think Dr. Peter Gray has questioned this well, and I agree with him from my own experience as well, both, you know, in juvenile justice and as teacher, that when you say that school is the norm and you make that a default category of you're supposed to be doing this, and if you're X, you know, a couple weeks even out of that window, there's a problem, is very concerning and, you know, doesn't match empirical reality, right? The idea that every single person is supposed to be within a couple weeks of knowledge within each other. And if you don't, there's something fundamentally flawed with you, not just that your biology is advancing at a different rate. I mean, it's just such a ridiculous thing that, especially been like a seventh grade teacher like I have been, and you see a whole spectrum of young people where some of them look like they're still babies and some of them are like, okay, wow, they matured really quick, right? You can see the genetic and biological differences widen among young people as they hit puberty. And it's just, it's so kind of insane to see that and to know that the development is different for different people and to not recognize how that might affect, you know, the ability to have in the school norm, of course, executive functioning skills, which executive functioning skills, again, for those who don't know, is just how much you can plan your future and think about the future and, you know, order what you have to do and prioritize. And that's, you know, often what's spoken to when they say, oh, this student doesn't turn in their homework or they don't write things in their agenda, right? They call that executive functioning skills. And there's no meaningful analysis that is done in schools about biological development. And I know this both just from a research perspective, you know, doing my own research into the psychological literature as relates to public schools, and having talked to and sat in on many specials teams meetings where, you know, I'm there with psychologists and psychiatrists, doctoral people mm-hmm. who I'm working with and talking with about young people and how they approach the subject and how they talk about young people. And one of the most, I think, disgusting examples that I saw was one specialist. This wasn't a psychologist. I think they're an ESE specialist talked about a student who had said literally, and I'm not, exaggerating here. They literally said, I don't want to be in school. I'd rather be, working on boats, right? They wanted to do stuff with, boats. They wanted to work on boats, stuff like that, And she just laughed at him, basically, like, what's wrong with you, right? I mean, it's that sick.
Oh, it's like trypanemia. I mean, you remember it was Bruce Levine who was mm-hmm. a psychologist, and he mm-hmm. wrote critically of school, or he might have been a psychiatrist, actually. He made this comparison to this disease that Samuel Cartwright, who was a doctor in the middle of the 1800s, mm-hmm. he diagnosed runaway slaves with. Right? Mm-hmm. Drapetomania was like this desire to flee captivity, And so it was actually in a last ditch effort. And this is like a good indication that this institution of slavery is coming to an end, where we have to invent mental problems that people would have for trying to run away from it. Right. There was another one that I think was similar to oppositional defiant disorder. It was called like dystysia aesiopis or something like that. And Cartwright might have originated that. But that was like a slave's failure to be attentive to the needs of the master. Right. Mm. So almost oppositional defiant or ADHD. Yeah. I mean, to get that response, that takes us back 150 years ago to people trying to justify a completely immoral and failing, and everybody knows it's failing, institution. And obviously, I think, the parallels between that in school, even though it's super hyperbolic, and I get that. I know people don't like that, but there are parallels, right? If you abstract, there are parallels, and that's a good one.
I agree. I completely agree. I don't shy away from that language either, because it is. And it's way more pernicious of a lie to suggest it's not, in my opinion, because by extending it to all people, then it hides it, right? If it's violence against one demographic, well, okay, that's bad, right? But then if you do it to everybody, well, okay, we're all suffering, right? It's crazy.
By the way, do you remember how old this boy was who wanted to work on boats?
Yeah, he was 12 years old.
Jeez.
And he came from an abusive, neglectful family. His brother was diagnosed with things and was at a school for, troubled youth. And he told me that his brother would stomp on him and do horrible things, and he couldn't get sleep. Yeah. And I was like, these people are just, that is the people who are these ESE specialists and stuff like that. A lot of them are sick. They're really genuinely sick.
Well, that's why I kind of shuddered at 12 years old, because it's young enough to be susceptible to the condemnation of a specialist, but it's old enough to see the world. And it's old enough to have some identity and to know what you want to do and know what brings you meaning and satisfaction. So that sucks. Yeah.
It was an example for me of one young person who had that awareness. He knew that things were bad. He understood his own interests and was able to articulate them actually really well, mm-hmm. surprisingly well. And to me, that was actually one of the most concerning elements, is just how much those, who were supposed to be there helping him at this meeting just disregarded him and dehumanized him. He clearly articulates his own needs and wants in an intelligent way, not something flippant I just want to sit and eat bonbons. Mm-hmm. He says, no, I just would rather, I enjoy working with boats, being in the water. I'd rather, be able to do something and study things like that. So that was, another element of grave concern for me, and just being able to really see how those who are in control of the exceptional student coordination are furthering the abuse of young people. They are there supposedly to help them, but in reality, their only goal is to get them to conform to the classroom, because that's what it's all about at the end of the day. It doesn't matter whether it's the courts, it doesn't matter whether it's, these, special needs or specialists. They are just there until the kid signals what it is that they are commanding them to do. And that's whatever, you know, behavior is, just to be obedient, whatever the grades are, just, you know, be, you know, A, B sooner, at least, you know, something like that, you know, on the upper end. I mean, that's all I care about. If you have the signals, whatever, they don't care about you. And it's really tragic to see that manifested. And I got to, you know, intimately see that, not just on that student, but on many different students and situations. And in fact, the administration even tried to have me get that student arrested so that he could be removed from the school because it was causing so much of a problem. So, it goes that deep.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's pretty messed up.
Can we jump back before we go any further? Can we jump back to the executive functioning thing? Because I used to write, I was a special ed teacher for a while. So I wrote a lot of IEPs. I don't know if you've written them. I'm sure you've read them, right? Executive function. Have you written them?
Yes, I've been a part of the specialist teams writing them. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sure the process has evolved a lot in the 15 years between us doing it, probably. But I'm not sure. I don't know. But I remember it was a lot of copying, pasting into Word documents. But you know, executive functioning was, especially with the group of kids that I was working with, it was commonplace. You know, in a lot of their IEPs, and so I know this is appearing in IEPs. And I think you mentioned feeling like it was ignored, especially when you have some developmental variety around, you know, the age of students that you're working with. But it's certainly, it's there in the report. What do you think happens, or why do you think it gets overlooked?
Oh, in terms of why they look at, like, holistically at their whole life with executive functioning?
Sure.
Oh, well, because the way they take executive functioning for their purposes is just signaling, right? Like, they don't care about, you know, what their diet is, or whether their parents are going through a divorce, whether their dog died. They're just like, oh, did you turn your homework? Okay, good. Mm-hmm. You know, were you there on time to class? You're not tardy? Okay, good. They don't care, as long as everybody gives the signaling they want. And that's why, and I'm sure you've seen this plenty, right? What are the favorite kids of teachers behind closed doors, right? Because teachers have their teachers meetings and they talk about other students and things like that. The favorite kids are the ones who, even if they're not the best student, they don't have to be A students, they're the nicest ones, so the ones that are always there and obedient and on time, right? It's it's always about favoring those who are most complicit and, you know, joyful in obedience.
Yeah, and it's a natural feature of that environment, right? Because the teaching job is stressful too. So it's like, okay, if you're not a squeaky wheel and you don't need grease, thank you, I love you. Thank you for being here. I can identify with that. I can sympathize with that, you know, especially considering how out of control certain kids in my environment could be. And sometimes there was like a real correlation between liking a kid or feeling really positive about a kid and completely ignoring that kid, right? Mm-hmm. And because of the environment, the reason why you like him or her is because you can ignore them. You know,
it's a very sick cycle for many teachers. They perpetuate it, unfortunately. Yeah. I try my best not to. And, you know, I'm sure just like you, like a lot of the students liked me. I was like the fun teacher and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, you know what I mean, being the fun teacher is still an authoritarian who's helping to perpetuate the dysfunctions of what public school instills in young people, which is fundamentally this idea that your wants and needs are worthless as compares to your actions and obedience in school. And that anybody who questions the nature of compulsory schooling is almost like, in some, you know, Soviet era sense, this dysfunctional dissident person who needs, you know, conversion therapy or re-education camp. It really is that, and has increasingly become that, because the controls of what's expected in behavior have exponentially grown. The amount of time that the students spend in school, the amount of assignments that they have to do, or the amounts of signaling they have to do, at least in the digital world, is so much higher now that it's really overwhelming for most young people. And I still see that today as I work with young people and get to see how stressed out they are.
Yeah. So we've had a system in this country, at least for 170 years, that basically was about the subsumption of the individual, right? That basically put individual wants and needs and attributes
and goals on the back burner for this collectivist model, right? Or not even on the back burner. That's still something is still getting warm on the back burner, right? It's completely sacrificed for a lot of these kids. There have been revolutions in public education, but every revolution only created an expansion pack. You know, like it, maybe revolution is not the right word. Reform, right? There have been reforms, but every reform is only an expansion pack on the previous sort of individualism crushing environment that already exists. It's like, you know, the Prussians set up the system, the progressives come in and they go, oh, this is so authoritarian and so drill and kill. Well, I guess we'll use it to produce our utopia. You know, and then and that's happened since then. But at every stage, at every turn of the screw, it just becomes more and more accepted. So a lot of the things that we're talking about right now, I bet there's people working inside this environment who don't see any problem with it at all, because it is so the normal. And what's scary is that so many people out in the public, so many people are having this inflicted on them, young and old, parent and student, don't see it either.
It is. It's very tragic to see, and it keeps growing worse. Speaking like of what you're just talking about, going off of reforms, like even the most recent reform, you know, with the Common Core implementation, which I'm sure you love, right? I got to really study that and, you know, see how it manifested in the schools, because I was around when it manifested. And what happened is the Common Core principles or objectives are these kind of, you know, standards of learning what, you know, young people should do or be able to execute. And the various states adopted their own versions of it. And I often get this like pushback, like Common Core is not a teaching style. And I always like chuckle at that. I'm like, first off, how do you think the Common Core standards get implemented if they don't actually take what's in them and put them into the classroom in terms of executing what young people are learning about it, right? You know what I mean? It just makes no sense. Like, it's not teaching. I'm like, yeah, it's just the information that they're covering to make sure they met the benchmark. I mean, but I digress. But, you know, with the implementation of this and the style of how they were trying to achieve this, there's been a recent takeover. I say this like a pseudo private takeover, because again, when it's forced by the government, and it's being contracted out to a private company, you know, it's creating an artificial monopoly, right? The government is saying, okay, you're going to be the service provider. So what's happened with the Common Core rollout and with updates in the technology is that many of these, especially digital, but, you know, physical too, curriculum companies who have implemented these new standards have wanted to find ways to make it clear that you really need what they have to offer and you should keep buying more of their stuff, right? It's like they want to sell one solution and they want to sell the rest of the solutions behind it too, and keep those wheels greased by, you know, the forcible takings. So the implementation, especially what I've seen, has come in the form of these manners of asking students questions where inherently even some of the most brightest students are going to fail them. And how they fail at them is that the questions, especially in math, will have multiple parts to it. Mm-hmm. Where in the past you might have a, you know, closed-ended question, like solve this one problem, that's it, move on to the next one. Now it's like, you know, select all that apply, do part one, part two, part three. So you'll see like a 10 question quiz or something like that. And then you'll click on a question and it's like, wait, this is like six parts to it. Or like, oh, in order to solve this, I have to do six different math problems to eliminate ones that are not wrong, so I don't select. And how that hurts young people is they don't have the stamina for it. Like, by and large, again, there's always going to be brilliant kids and kids who are gifted or whatever you could say, good home support, that can handle it. But by and large, most young people don't have the stamina to keep up with these style of questions and how they're being presented in the name of, you know, they call it critical thinking skills, as of course, as you know, has nothing to do with critical thinking in itself. It's not teaching the skills. It's just having them even more intensively have to apply what would be critical thinking skills to do the questions, but they haven't even been taught it in the first place to use it, right? So,
and I'm sure there's no buy-in for it at all. I'm sure there's no investment in that, which also is going to compromise somebody's stamina.
Oh, like for the kids to want to do well?
I mean, well, that's par for the course in school, but I'm saying just as far as like stamina or perseverance, it's like perseverance happens when you're actually interested in the outcome of something for yourself.
Right. Yeah, I mean, of course, teachers will try to throw like, I'll give you a pizza party if we all pass, or, you know, behaviors and stuff.
Well, that's helpful.
Yeah. You know, besides that fact, that's just teachers trying to, you know, save their skin. But basically, these kids can't do it. It's literally designed for them to fail. And the design to fail on their end is brilliant. That is the company's end. It's not, of course, evil in empirical reality. But it's brilliant because by making these kids fail these exams, they are then selling their own remediation. And so what's happening is that in order to accommodate for this, many teachers and districts have started to like curve tests. So for example, I had a student who is an otherwise stellar student, A student. He's like, oh yeah, I just took this, you know, district math exam. I said, okay, great. How'd you do? He's like, oh, I got like a, you know, a C on it. I'm like, oh, well, that's not typical for you. He's like, yeah, but don't worry, they're gonna curve it. You know what I mean? So what they do is they have these kids take the test, they curve it behind the scenes when they say, well, they didn't actually meet the standards, so we got to do remediation. And then they sell more remediation packets, you know, and more extensive learning. And, you know, that has also disheartened kids.
All right. So they know their grades were back to like ninth place ribbons, right? And the psychic effect right. that has on people, like, I know I'm not good. And now adults are lying to me about it. And that feels like, you know, that makes me feel like crap. So now that's applied to academics, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, we'll curve behind the scenes, like you said. And that takes care of like the front end as far as like what the school needs to show as far as achievement is concerned. But in the back, we're going to kind of punish you with time and your sense of yourself anyway by remediating you because we have contractors to pay.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they do. They just say, well, we'll curve it for the sake of the class grade. But we, you know, in other words, they count it as a part of their grade because, you know, in some places the state mandated that they count these tests as part of their overall class grade. So they'll curve it for that. But then be like, oh, well, he didn't meet the benchmark. So let's make sure they, you know, get whatever remediation this or that or help that they need and sell more services and things like that. So it's really wild and twisted. And it's an unfortunate thing because I think it confuses a lot of people in the sense that they think, oh, that's like private market and this or that. And it's like, this is not private market. This is not freedom and learning. This is a crony contractor coming in, selling it to the government and then causing more problems and then trying to sell, like, you know, in many ways the government does, their solutions to the problems they cause in the first place, which is by design made to make students, you know, fit a bell curve. Like they're literally trying to, instead of being like, you know, their typical math tests where a lot of people could get A's, they're trying to make it difficult, almost like a standardized test, to fit a bell curve.
Yep.
For the sake of like figuring out who should go where. And it's really sick, you know, what it does to these young people who they essentially feel worthless and shamed. And like, even though they work so hard, some of them, you know, again, not, it could be intrinsic. It also could just be they're just signaling. But I mean, whatever it is, they felt good about themselves because at least they got their A's. And all of a sudden they see this like, what's wrong with me? And they think, you know, they're worthless. It's very sad.
Yeah.
Which, of course, just part of the nature of the grading system itself, you know, that all or nothing thinking it breeds. But this type of cronyism, of course, is also pervasive in the teacher evaluations as well. And I got to see how cronyism there was taking place with this kind of teacher evaluation system called Marzano.
Mm-hmm.
And Marzano has been a very popularly sold, you could say, teacher evaluation system across many states. And they have this like very, you could say, mathematically based way of kind of analyzing everything and like check marking all these different categories and observations and different levels and stuff, right? They try to make it seem like as if it's super scientific when it's really not, you know,
right.
But just, you know, the AP comes and just looks at you and for one day and that's it, you know. But it's the same kind of thing, I think, that teachers have been experiencing as students within this, which is a really interesting paradigm to see, that the teachers themselves have also become frustrated with the system and how they've been evaluated, right? They think that's unfair, that they're not being properly rewarded with praise and raises based on these, you know, pseudoscientific ways of measuring their performance. In many ways, akin to the students who are experiencing the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I was in graduate school when No Child Left Behind was being rolled out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was 2003, 2004. The complaints were the same. You know, like everybody in my classes in graduate school was already a public school teacher in New York or Massachusetts, or maybe a few from Vermont. And this was just so much of the dialogue that we were having in class. It was almost like more of a support group for current teachers than a graduate school for prospective teachers. Mm. And I remember I don't know if I could articulate it as well then, but I remember this feeling of dread, like, why would I go? I'd been so motivated to teach, like, by experiences that I had with really, like, one professor in college around the subject of history. That was what motivated. I already was teaching it. In fact, I was in grad school and I was like running a program at a private school for kids who had had what they called at the time sexually reactive behavior issues. And I knew that wasn't my ultimate destination. I knew I had to get into teaching history and I knew I had to jump through all the hoops. I mean, what else could you do in 2003 or 2004 if you wanted to talk about history with kids? I didn't know another way. So you know, I'm there, I'm sitting through these classes, I'm listening to these stories, and the feeling of dread that was unarticulated at the time was like, why would I go back to something that I hated so much? I mean, these people sound like the voice in my head when I was a high school student, you know? It's powerlessness, right? It's like total awareness of this judgment, this loss of control, and it just, like within a semester or two, the whole prospect of it became very, very unappealing to me. And that was more than 15 years ago. I'm sure it's worse now.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah. That whole, you know, No Child Left Behind and everything else that was attempting to try to, you know, they said they want to standardize everything and make it all equal and fair in terms of valuations. I mean, it's all, of course, it's going to be all a lot of garbage because you're evaluating, you know, qualitative things and diverse audiences that you can't compare a group of, you know, one group of young people to another. It's just, you know, right. It's apples and oranges and their experience and everything. So it's very silly to even try to do that. You know, it's really kind of, you know, a self-defeating thing. But even more than ever, that's what happened, is that there was this drift toward trying to standardize everything, trying to, I guess you could say, itemize all the scores and have people be more self-reflective, you know, whether it was teachers or students, you know, because it kind of happened somewhat in tandem in the past, you know, I'd say 10 years, that, you know, you'd be like writing journals about how you're doing and like, oh, I feel like I'm doing a level 3 today. I think I know most of the stuff. I mean, they were doing this stuff to both kids and the teachers. Mm. But fundamentally, of course, the teachers were the ones who actually could leave. You know, so
yeah.
By and large. So what happened naturally, and I think you've probably seen and read up on this, I'm sure, that the teacher shortages around the country went
right.
the roof, of
right.
course, right? Mm. Because all these teachers now are like, okay, the system that evaluates me is junk. I'm being judged constantly on things that are outside my control. I'm not getting raises. I have no, you know, authority in the classroom, again, independently of my ethics, or just the concept of just being able to have classroom management for their own safety.
Or even some autonomy. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Or autonomy too. Exactly. Right. The turnover became, you know, a pandemic really. So now what we have in public schools today, by and large, from what I've seen, this is, you know, looking at my own experiences and talking to many others, is that the number of people who are in teaching today who are long-term teachers are basically just there to get their pension, make it through. The young or new teacher turnover rate is exceedingly high. It's crazy. It really is nuts. In many mainline public schools, your typical average public school, they're having out of field teachers everywhere. They're having long-term substitutes everywhere. They can't get anybody in. Nobody wants to be there. So now, on top of what's already a very dysfunctional environment, an authoritarian environment, an environment where young people are spending a third of the year preparing for state and district exams, where they're being constantly monitored, they can't even have any semblance of stability in their classrooms because all the time it's like, oh, I got a new teacher this week. Oh, this teacher's out. Oh, I got a sub now. I mean, literally, the turnover is mind-boggling of how bad it is. And virtually all the students I've had, I've seen it time and again, especially in mainline public schools, they have a teacher and, you know, soon enough, boom, they're out of there. And then there's a substitute and they come in a new one and then boom, they're out of there. So the stability, even within the schooling paradigm, is just, you know, completely shot. It is really and truly a bad time to be in a public school more than ever. I mean, in just every possible conceivable way, it has become an authoritarian nightmare. And on top of that, of course, with the, you know, the unfounded scares of, you know, mass shooters and the code red drills, stuff like that, now many of these schools are scaring kids and telling them, oh, you're going to get shut up. We got to do these shooter drills. Oh, we got to have like live action fire and police with dogs coming through and all this other stuff. So now it really is like a 1984 situation today, because in many schools, they have the drug dogs, they have the cops, they have the controls, they have the monitoring, they have the security cameras everywhere. And now they have the drills of the constant fear of the enemy that could come. And they have to worry, oh, you know, am I going to get shot today? Even though they're literally more likely to die, but literally statistically more likely to die by a lightning strike than to be shot and killed in a mass school shooting. They're all thinking that that's, you know, the next thing. Oh, you know, something bad's going to happen. So, I mean, it really is an Orwellian nightmare that young people are experiencing today. And it's something that if you take, you know, if you're able to get out and get the big picture, which for a lot of people is very hard to do, because, you know, if you're in it, you're a parent, you're just focused on, oh, my kids just got to do well so they, you know, survive and get to college. If you're a teacher, you're just, you know, grading papers and just try to make it through the semester. You know, really take some time to step out and think about the whole of what's happening, you know. From the first moment a child walks in and they're doing the pledge and then, you know, taking roll and controlling kids, everything else that's going on with monitoring them and checking them and the testing. I mean, it's just sick. It's really a sick system through and through.
Yeah. And while I think it was always like, even when I was talking about this, so when I started School Sucks, I remember I was, you know, I was still working as a tutor. And like I said earlier in our conversation, it was a different world. Right. But I remember in about maybe 2010, I was working with a kid. I think he was a freshman in high school. And I had just gone and I had just done a preliminary meeting with him and his mother. And within the next week, before I went back, he committed suicide because he was being bullied in school. He went to my high school, the high school that I graduated from in New Hampshire. If I had known, and not that I couldn't have done anything about it, and that's a torturous way to even think about it for sure. But if there had been a way for that kid to understand, to have the perspective 10 years ago, that this is going to seem like such a small part of your life, as far as like, it's a lot of time and it's a lot of memories. And for a lot of kids, it's a lot of trauma, but it's finite. And I don't remember feeling that way when I was in middle school or when I started high school. It felt like it was going to be the rest of my life. And also, like I said earlier in the conversation, it was my whole world. And today, even though I think that communication and information technology has brought with it lots of problems and lots of new challenges, not insurmountable challenges, and I think it's exciting to be alive at a time where people are trying to overcome them, and I know that they can have really difficult consequences for young people too, like social media and bullying happening. They're just like the school being extended into these platforms is a terrible thing. But we're in the growing pains, training wheels kind of phase of this right now. And one thing that I think is exciting is that kids can see how much of the world is beyond the school experience. And they can also, I'm hoping that this is already happening. Like I said, I've been out of the game for a while. The impact that school is having on them is also being lessened by this exposure to the outside world. So the first revolution of this was maybe television and just going and watching television and seeing how much, like, it's not the best window to existence, but it's one that shows you how much bigger the world actually is. And now I don't even want to try and put a number on it, a millionfold, a billionfold, the impact of the internet as far as like the size of the world and what's out there. But I'm really hoping that is a revolution that has already started to happen. And I think it has. And, you know, we hear about kids like fact-checking teachers with their phones, and I think that's great. But I really hope that that has a like a powerful and meaningful and lasting effect on the school experience, not just as far as like showing young people what's possible, but also leading them to take school less seriously, especially in the ways that it impacts them negatively. You know, that boy didn't have that perspective. I didn't have that perspective when I was a student. And it's my greatest hope that more kids do today, even if there are some challenges of the technology that brings that realization to them.
I do hope so too. I definitely agree with you with, you know, there being some tragic outcomes of the bullying. I actually, one of his classmates just committed suicide and hung himself. He was 12. And, you know, the ability to bully, of course, has increased with the ability to use, you know, social media to bully and things like that. But I do think that the net benefit overall with young people being able to seek other communities or seek other ideas is definitely there. And I think there is a spirit of rebellion that's looming, a good rebellion, an intellectual rebellion, with young people realizing that there's better ways to learn if they're going to, you know, do math or, you know, learn about English and stuff like that. There could be better ways to learn. I think the internet is definitely helping with that. You know, it's kind of up to people like us and others in this realm to communicate that as best we can while we still can, that there are things beyond school and alternatives to the compulsory schooling paradigm. Because as I'm sure you've seen plenty, many of those in the institutions rule by fear, and they prey on the fears of young people and parents, and parents, you know, perpetuate a bit, that you will be nothing or you'll be unsuccessful unless you signal the way that they want, that, you know, your life is meaningless without school, and, you know, boogeyman, like don't even think about it, because you'll just be, you know, a street bum if you decide to do another type of educational path, or, you know, just get your GED and do, you know, do something else. Yeah. So I think that that's so important right now, because, you know, there is a current, I could say, governmental initiative to try to stop that from happening. From what I've seen, you know, like the FCC, in terms of trying to censor people saying, like, oh, if you're reaching children on YouTube and things like that, you know, you got to, like, mark your videos a certain way, and trying to, you know, go after people for those kinds of things. I think, you know, there are people who are bad predators and they try to exploit children, but there's that catch 22 of government control, which is, like, you know, those in the state want to make sure that they maintain a monopoly on the minds of the young, which is, of course, the foundation of what compulsory schooling is being able to control the formation of a young person's mind into, you know, proverbial adulthood. And so breaking through that paradigm is going to require some very heavy guerrilla tactics to break through that kind of matrix and reach young people. But I do think that right now, thanks to the decentralization that we have with alternative media and social media, that there is a chance that many could hear that message and try to, even if they can't get out because of their parents, try to at least in their own time be inspired to direct their own learning and self-direct their own learning in a way that is meaningful to them. So,
yeah. And there's no time that I think it's more crucial. I mean, we've had in this country a government trying to standardize and render predictable its citizenry for 170 years, yeah, right? For a variety of reasons. And, like, you know, I'm not into telling this story in terms of black and white, good and evil, because I think it makes it too easy for people to dismiss it as a conspiracy, right? Like, if it starts to sound too wacky, like evil people, the religious people and those who task themselves with the preservation of American society as slavery was ending, as the first wave of immigration began, as the Industrial Revolution began and increased, I think they saw themselves from their bubble, from their ivory tower, as the responsible people who looked forward and, you know, wanted to save society. I think the progressives looked at themselves the same way. I think the behaviorists, you know, might have been a little bit more disconnected and scientific about it. But, you know, you have to understand that a lot of people probably looked out at a changing America with a great deal of terror if they were into preserving the order as it existed. Today, that terror must be, like, off the charts. There has never been more competitors, right, for the minds of young people on the field at once. And what that means, and one of the reasons why I began this statement by saying it's crucial, is because that also means that the efforts to standardize and render predictable the young citizenry are, you know, reaching new heights, which is basically what you've laid out here in the last hour and a half or so. And I appreciate you doing so. But before we wrap up, even though I said I had to be done at 2:30, let's keep going, because this is just like, this has been such an easy conversation. I'm tempted to never write an outline for a show again, or even ask a guest what their name is before we start, because this has been great. But you left us with a really good transition to talking about your online project, how it started, what your mission is, and where you see it going next.
Sure. Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. That's very kind of you. So when it came to this idea of like the honest teacher, I started writing a book about my experiences and my thoughts about what's happening, because I realized that most people just don't even know, like they don't even have the ability to know what's in specificity is taking place behind closed doors and in schools. They're not allowed there, right? You know, yeah. Parents can't sit in the classroom and just like, I'm going to sit here and observe all day what you do every day. Like, you know, they don't have, you know, recordings and stuff like that. The only way you get to see is if you're there working or if you're there as a student. And the unfortunate part is that if you're a student and you're too awake, they're going to come after you and try to silence you or medicate you or get you moved out or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So what I realized that that's the only way to get in there and communicate in specificity what's taking place. I was like, okay, well, I'll do this for as long as I can hold out, you know, with teaching and just see what I can note down and observe and get in concrete form what is taking place and why it's so concerning. And the page I created ended up being just like my way to kind of like blow off some steam, just to like talk about specific things, the things I saw and ideas, because I thought, eh, the book will take too long to finish. This is too important of a topic to not start actually telling people, hey, this is what's going on. Here's some screenshots of this. Here's, you know, some questions that students are being given. Here's materials they're having teachers read about and understand and implement. I just was like, no, I got to just get this out there. So I just started posting things while I was still teaching on the last legs and just continued doing that even afterward. And I had done tutoring and things like that on the side. I started a tutoring company while I was still teaching to transition out of, and eventually I did. And I transitioned to that and then still used, you know, my opportunities with working with young people just to still check in and see what's actually happening. Since I had the behind the scenes and I, you know, knew the new teacher trainings and the ongoing trainings, the tactics they were using with students, you know, in terms of Common Core implementation, what was happening, you know, with how students were being treated in terms of social control, you know, I knew enough at that point that I was like, okay, I can like now take a window with just working one-on-one with students and seeing their homework and seeing their assignments, their communication and stuff, and still be able to report on what's going on. So, you know, I just kind of went with it, and I mostly made memes and things like that because memes are fun and everybody likes a good meme.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So some of those memes, you know, did all right. And I made some videos too. Nothing I'm like crazy proud of or anything. Just try to throw a couple of things together here and there. But you know, by and large, my focus was always just how much I could try to communicate some of the key objections and overcome them, and some of the key resources that I recommend to students and families to help them get out of that school mindset and the dysfunctional communication. It's just things that I personally really valued. And I think from what I've seen from you as well over the years, you really value as well, like nonviolent communication and peaceful parenting and things like that. For me, those are kind of the roots. You know, if you don't have self-knowledge and heal yourself first, it's kind of hard to functionally move forward and have good relationships. So that's kind of like my ground level there is, you know, how can you take care of yourself physically, emotionally, mentally, and then how can you employ those skills with your other relationships? If you're a parent, you know, with your child, if you're a teacher, hopefully it wakes you up enough to be like, oh, okay, I got to get out of here. Mm-hmm. If you're a student, maybe it gives you a sense of hope that at least you can work on yourself and try to feel better about yourself, that, you know, you're not a lost cause and that you're not worthless just because, you know, people bully you at school or teachers tell you you're not going to be anything. So to me, that's kind of, you know, my core virtues and values there. But over the years, I just kind of just did it haphazardly. And then I would get tons of messages from parents saying, hey, how could I self-direct my, you know, kids learning? Hey, you know, what was that book again about peaceful parenting? Hey, I want to do this. I'm like, okay, well, I guess people want to know. So fortunately, through my work, from what I've seen, again, I'm not there physically with them, but from what they've told me, dozens of families have turned to unschooling or self-directed learning centers, have worked toward nonviolent communication, peaceful parenting, things like that, because of the resources that I've shared. So, you know, I was just happy that that happened. For me, it was kind of paying it forward for my own past and hurts that I've been through and traumas I've been through, and trying just to help people be able to have some peace and move toward, you know, understanding and moving away from that all or nothing thinking. I think that, to me, that's the core of public school, is that is this all or nothing thinking mindset, that you're all good or all bad. If you don't signal this, you're worthless. Mm-hmm. You know, what's wrong with you? So, you know, if I can help get people to break free of that stricture, for me, that just brings me joy in itself. Like, just to know that there's people who were able to go and become peaceful parents or help their kid get out of that toxic environment is, to me, the biggest deal. So,
yeah,
that's kind of what I did.
Well, Jay, we speak the same language, you know, and this has actually been a really motivating and inspiring conversation for me, because I can really identify with a lot of those motivations, especially early on and keeping going with this. And, you know, I'm very grateful for the connections that I've made with people who helped turn the volume up on this stuff when it came to, you know, peaceful parenting or, you know, NVC. One of the things that I really like about your work, you simultaneously pursue problems and solutions. If people aren't aware of the problems, that saps motivation. If they're not reminded about the problems, it hinders their willingness, their ability, their desire to find solutions. So your page, The Honest Teacher on Facebook, does both and goes back and forth. And I think that's really important. You know, I did my podcast for like 3 or 4 years before I said, how am I going to hook anybody into this? Like, how would I, you know, I mean, we were doing okay, but, you know, you have outreach, like explainer style animated videos. You use a lot of memes. I've never myself gotten into memes, and you're giving people an introduction. You're giving people a way to at least start asking questions, right? And challenging what they believe through digestible means. And I think that's really, really important. I am disappointed that this is the first time we've ever talked. I feel like we could have done a lot together, and I hope we can in the future. Thank you for all your time. Thank you for all your wisdom. Thank you for your updates, by the way, on everything that is happening in school in the current year. Because like I said, I've been out of it for a while. Yeah, let's do this again. There's plenty we can talk about.
Absolutely. And I've enjoyed your work for many years. So
awesome.
I definitely have enjoyed it, and, you know, really appreciate that you're willing to talk to people and help broaden their perspective, you know, on the nature of schooling, because a lot of people just don't get it. There's too much they have invested psychologically in the construct of just this, you know, this idea of, oh, well, that's what you have to do. You know, how else are you going to, you know, learn, right? Where does learning come
yes.
from otherwise?
And, sure.
You know, it takes those long conversations, you know, as you said, I think, well, you know, my memes try to get that spark with people to get them.
That's it. Yep.
Curious about, wait, what? Like, and to challenge your thinking, but there's no way around it. I mean, we're talking about the nature of what compulsory schooling has done. I mean, it's years and generations of trauma, literal cycles of trauma, people being abused, and then perpetuating that abuse, rationalizing the abuse. And it really just takes a breaking of that. You have to get to the point where you've withered away those walls enough to have a conversation.
Yep.
And to talk at length about the nature of what young people feel in that and what it's doing to them. And that's, I think, to me, why I still even value the tutoring and things that I do, because at least at a bare minimum, I get to talk to young people and be able to actually empathize with them and be a listening ear when they're often shut down. And I offer, you know, when I can, if there's issues and stuff like that with their communication in the home, I try to help mediate that, and then sometimes offer the help of a counselor too. So even just little things like that, you know, just to try to diffuse some of the tension. Because I'm sure you've seen too, being a tutor, right? You know, there's some people who just need some academic help, like, oh, I want to take the SAT. But sometimes, you know, you're there because there's a fundamental communication breakdown between a child and the parent, and the parent kind of wants to force them to just signal and just, why aren't you doing this, right? And the kid doesn't feel heard. They feel their needs aren't being met. They feel like nobody really cares about them, and that, you know, their thoughts, their ambitions are just worthless and discarded. And it's hard to be alone in that, and to feel like nobody out there is going to listen to you, or just empathize with you, even if it's small.
Right.
So, you know, it's a big tragedy. And it's also something too that teachers prey on too. I'll throw that out there, right? Like that teachers often prey on the emotions of young people sometimes and wanting to be nice, right? Because they're like, oh, well, I'll be a support for them. I'll be kind and stuff like that. And you have a lot of go-getter teachers that like want to be in that relationship. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes Stockholm because, right? On one hand, they're like, oh, I'm going to be a listening ear and be your buddy. On the other hand, I'm going to stigmatize you with grades and tell you, you know, if you don't do this, there's something wrong with you. So
I still have to do all the things that stop me from being abused.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's true. And I think there's also a possibility when people start out that way in the profession with really high expectations, they're the ones who wind up most jaded and disaffected later on. And, right. You know, I remember when I worked with this population of kids who had committed sexual offenses, and I was talking to the psychologist about how we could modify the program because it was like a jail. And, you know, the one thing he said to me was they replicate abuse that they've suffered because it normalizes abuse. And then I zoomed out and it was all I saw anywhere with so much of what's going on in the schools. And, you know, that, right. that extends in many cases to families as well. And, you know, that's why some of these things that you're talking about are so important, like calling out, making explicit, you know, step one, admit that there's a problem type stuff. And then like also giving people the supports they need to start facing that and to start solving that. So,
and being a stalwart too for freedom and autonomy, because I know that the young people you worked with, a part of the thing that you focused on with the troubled youth was that you wanted to not have them be so controlled, that they should have freedom and not be constantly watched and monitored and treated as if they're, you know, prisoners or criminals. And it's like, how do you get someone to move from that mindset if you're constantly talking to them and treating them as if they are that bad person, that all bad person?
Right.
And so I know that in your work, that was one of the things you did, is you tried to move young people out of that being totally controlled and giving them freedom and respect in conversations.
Thank you. I think that was the point before I had the vocabulary to try and say, like, we're not going to send these kids out into the worst Orwellian dystopia that's ever been conceived of. So we should stop preparing them for such. But Jay, thanks again. We will definitely do a repeat of this in the near future. And I really, really look forward to it. I got a lot out of today's conversation. This was awesome.
Me too. You're awesome.
Thank you. All right.